new shows and fresh ideas every day. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
I'd like to welcome you to this program. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Each week at this time, we take a single issue and explore it in a way that the mainstream media would not dare to. Today, October Surprise. That's prior to Ronald Reagan's election in 1980. However, why do a program that is 30 years old in its subject matter? Because I believe, as do many others I've spoken with recently, that there is a relevance of the October Surprise today, and a look at how our government covers up its own crimes. The person best able to share insights is a former White House insider. Barbara Honegger is a former White House policy analyst and special assistant to the Assistant to the President for Domestic Policy, and a nationally recognized investigative journalist, especially with her current work on challenging the official story of the 9/11. And in light of that, what went wrong at the Pentagon that we weren't told about? She was called as an expert witness at the first international hearings on 9/11 held in Toronto. And earlier, she was a senior military affairs journalist at the Department of Defense's Naval Postgraduate School. She is, however, best known for her book, October Surprise, which exposes the Reagan team's Irangate and led to a full federal investigation in the House. She is also among the first 50 high-level former current government officials to call for a new 9/11 investigation, and she is a founding member of the international organization Political Leaders for 9/11 Truth. Nice to have you back with us, Barbara.
Hi, Gary. Can you hear me?
Yes, I'm just going to ask you to speak up, please.
All right. Can you hear me now?
Much better, and I'll ask our engineer to keep your levels a little higher. Barbara,
before
we go to the whole story of the October Surprise and what you learned while writing your book and what you've learned since, I want to make it very current today. My concern is that we went into Libya vis-a-vis NATO and special operations forces on the ground, not because we were concerned about Colonel Gaddafi directly. We had other agendas. I believe that the same is true for Syria and that we're only receiving one side of the picture. What is your understanding of the United States' secret support for extreme jihadist organizations such as the Muslim Brotherhood, or what happened in Libya, or al-Qaeda-related groups? Talk about that in relationship to things that are happening right now as we speak.
Well, I'm glad you framed it that way, Gary, because on the side of Iran-Contra, which was a scandal in the Reagan-Bush senior administration over 30 years ago. But the relevance today is that, and we'll go into why this is true, the October Surprise has now been proven by now declassified documents and proves that the right-wing party, the Republican Party in the United States, for decades has been working behind the scenes with the most radical elements of Islam, both the Shiite side, which was the Khomeini regime in Iran, i.e. the October Surprise Arms for Hostage Delay deal, that defeated Jimmy Carter, and also subsequently we have been the covert operations side of the United States government has been working with al-Qaeda. It is now well known that we were working with al-Qaeda elements in Libya to bring down Gaddafi, and it's also very well known, of course, that the CIA created al-Qaeda to try to get the Soviets out of Afghanistan. We also are, the United States, Britain, NATO, and Israel are running al-Qaeda elements, the Baluchi al-Qaeda elements against Iran inside of Iran and have been for a very long time. So the United States government secretly while it is saying that Al-Qaeda and the Iranians are our number one enemy and that radical Islam is our number one enemy, on the other hand, we are working with them when the goals suit us. This is an extremely dangerous game, and I think it's time for it to stop.
Examine now what is happening in Mali and other areas where people that we funded and we armed, vis-a-vis Saudi Arabia in some cases, other countries in other cases, but now those terrorists have taken those weapons back into different parts of Africa and are now using them to destabilize some of the governments in those areas. So isn't that your traditional form of blowback?
Well, it may be blowback. It may be the tip of the iceberg that we're able to see of a much deeper secret foreign policy. We actually can't be sure about that. One of the things that I would like to mention that people probably don't know about is that Sybil Edmonds, who is a top whistleblower on 9/11, was a translator for the FBI. She's written a brilliant book. And she has revealed and stated very clearly on her website, Boiling Frog's website, that when she translated documents high up in the FBI, she learned that Osama bin Laden was an agent of the United States and the West right up to and including on 9/11. So even bin Laden at the very top of Al-Qaeda, which is of course, the official lie of 9/11, of who really did 9/11, which is a lie, the very top Al-Qaeda bad guy, the enemy du jour of 9/11, bin Laden was actually working for our side. So what is really going on? We, the United States, NATO, Israel and Britain use these Islamic fundamentalist elements both on the Shiite side, that is Iran primarily, and on the Sunni side, which is Al-Qaeda primarily, when it suits our own ends geopolitically. That's the bottom line people need to understand. Now, to go back to the October surprise and Iran, the relevance of that today is that we are having actually the second inauguration of President Obama today. But 32 years ago yesterday, as Ronald Reagan held his hand up to take the oath of office on January 20th of 1981, immediately after he became president and George Bush Sr. became vice president, right after their oaths, the Khomeini regime released the 52 hostages in Iran. Everyone knew that there was something fishy about that timing, but that is what triggered my quest to understand what was really behind that non-coincidental timing and led to my research on and the publication of my book, October Surprise, which proved that the Reagan-Bush campaign in 1980, the Republican campaign, had cut a secret deal with the most radical Islamicist regime on the planet at the time, the Khomeini regime, dealing with Khomeini's own son to delay the release of the hostages who were then held and tortured, many of them, for an additional 3 months until they were released, non-coincidentally, as Reagan took oath of office. So that's the reason for the coincidence or non-coincidence of today's topic. Because okay. Today is Inauguration Day.
I want to take a few more moments to talk about a few issues that you may or may not have some specific insight into. Last week on our program, we spoke with Ray McGovern and some others on different conspiracy issues. I did not have a chance to ask him the following. Did he believe, or do you now believe, that we have been given the full and honest accounting of Osama bin Laden's murder and in Pakistan and everything that was supposed to have happened since Brennan, who was overseeing all that and was the president's top intelligence officer on that issue, has contradicted himself several times. And when the top cabinet people and the top military and security and national security agency people were all sitting in a room and watching in real time what happened, and the CIA was watching in real time what happened, with that many people watching in real time, how could they have gotten so many things wrong? And now we're told that Osama bin Laden stuck his head out of a doorway and he was immediately killed. There was no firefight. And my question is this: if that is the real story, why were they not told that they should bring him back as a prisoner, knowing that he would be one of the most important intelligence assets in history? He would know all about the truth behind 9/11, supposedly. He would know the Saudi connection. He would know the Pakistani connection, the Pakistani intelligence connection. He would know about all the funding. Why would you kill someone? It would be just as easy to wound him and then bring him back and interrogate him. And do you believe the official story? Do you have any evidence to challenge it?
Oh, my God, yes. No one can read David Ray Griffin's book, Bin Laden, Dead or Alive, which was published long before the alleged raid on Bin Laden's compound in May of last year. No one can, or 2011, no one can possibly read that book and believe that Bin Laden was still alive at the time of the May 1st, 2011 raid. It's impossible. The evidence is overwhelming that the real Bin Laden was killed or died as a result of wounds he received at Tora Bora, and that he died in mid-December of 2001, immediately after 9/11. All of the tapes, both the videotapes and the audio tapes that were allegedly of Bin Laden, were churned out by probably the CIA's, but some top intelligence agency's propaganda, video propaganda wing, and they are clearly not of Bin Laden. One of the world's foremost Bin Laden experts took a look at those videotapes and audio tapes, listened to the audio tapes. He had studied every single word and written books on Bin Laden, and he said there's no way that those tapes, those audio and videotapes, after Bin Laden's, the real Bin Laden's death in mid-December of 2001, could possibly actually be Bin Laden. So it's impossible for Bin Laden to have died in right after 9/11 and also be the individual who was taken out. So the bottom line is they couldn't bring the body that they claim is Bin Laden back. They had to kill whoever that was. Now, I have a very interesting story, a true story to tell you.
Barbara, speak directly into the telephone. You're coming in and out, in and out.
All right, all right. I'm going to tell you an interaction I had with Leon Panetta, who was CIA director, and according to the official story, oversaw the Bin Laden raid. I'm going to tell you a true story of my interaction, my personal one-on-one interaction with him. We were standing approximately a foot and a half apart on the weekend following the alleged Bin Laden raid. And Leon Panetta happens to live in the same small village that I do in California. It's called Carmel Valley, California. So that Saturday or Sunday, I went into the local mom-and-pop grocery store. It's a very small village. And Leon Panetta came in as I was in the store. And first off, you should know that when I was senior military affairs journalist at the Naval Postgraduate School, which is our Defense Department's premier science, technology, and national security affairs university, in about 2 weeks or 3 weeks before Panetta was nominated by President Obama to be his first CIA director, I was with Leon Panetta and his son James for a ceremony at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California, where I was then senior journalist. And I was covering the presentation to his son James, who had just come back from Afghanistan, of the Bronze Star Medal. And his son James, I wrote up that story, which was published on the DOD website. I can send that to you if you're interested. And James Panetta was, at the time, a prosecutor in, I believe, Alameda County. He's now, I believe, the deputy district attorney here in Monterey, California. But at the time, he was a prosecutor or DA in Alameda County, or up in the Bay Area, at the East Bay of San Francisco Bay Area in California. And he was also, however, a Navy reservist. And for his Navy reservist stint, he had just been for a number of months in Afghanistan, where he was working with the top secret special ops unit called the High Value Target Unit, where he was trying to find al-Zawahiri and bin Laden, and allegedly, and the so-called high value targets of al-Qaeda. And so he was given this Bronze Star. Well, I spoke to Leon Panetta there. And before Leon was even nominated for CIA director, after that meeting in which I interviewed Leon, of course, and his son James for the story on James's Bronze Star, I mentioned to Panetta that I was going to deliver to him David Ray Griffin's book, Bin Laden, Dead or Alive, which I did. It was delivered to his mailbox up the road from me in Carmel Valley. Leon Panetta knew that Bin Laden had to have died in mid-December of 2001, and he knew it before he was nominated as CIA director in late December or early January, right before Obama took his first oath of office. So, given that context, the weekend following the alleged Bin Laden raid, I was in the local grocery store. Leon Panetta walked in. He was at the checkout counter with the teller, cash register, and I came up after him with my groceries. I immediately saw him, and I said, "Leon, congratulations." He assumed I meant for the Bin Laden raid, and so he said, "Oh, shucks." You know, his persona is very, very gentle and believable. And his first reaction was, oh, well, that was a team effort. I can't take credit for that. And then I paused for a moment, and I said, "Leon, you and I both know that whoever it was you think you killed in Abbottabad this Monday was not Bin Laden. You know that because of David Ray Griffin's book, Bin Laden, Dead or Alive." And then Leon got uptight, and he pursed his lips while he was giving his money to the teller, the checkout person, the cashier. And it was just myself, Leon, and the cashier. And Leon said, well, DNA doesn't lie. And I said, "No, Leon, DNA doesn't lie. But the only problem with that is, whoever's body that was, as you well know, you threw it into the ocean," assuming that actually happened, but that's the official story. "You threw it into the ocean before a definitive match could have been made with the DNA from whosoever body that was and a relative of Bin Laden. And let me ask you, Leon, if you really believe that was Bin Laden's son Khalid, who was first killed on the stairway going up to the third floor, why didn't you bring his body back to match the DNA? Why don't we read that you've taken samples from his body to match with the body that you claim was Bin Laden? And why is it that instead the official story in the papers claim that the match that you claim proved that it was Bin Laden, which it couldn't have, was with the DNA from the pickled brain of one of Bin Laden's much further removed female relatives in a jar somewhere here in the United States, I believe in Virginia? So, Leon, will you allow me to prove to you that that was not Bin Laden?" And he said, "Yes, send me what you have," which I did. So I'm just here to tell you that this is a complete charade, the Bin Laden raid. Bin Laden was dead a very long time. And the real reason that they didn't want whosoever body that was is, number one, it wasn't Bin Laden. I do think there was a raid. I think it was a great piece of drama. And I think it was a brilliant, brilliant way to disarm the Republicans before this recent election so that no one could say that Obama was soft on terrorism or foreign policy.
Okay, those, of course, are not proven allegations, but yeah, I just ask for your own subjective analysis. I do know that when we were told early on, and it was never refuted, that Bin Laden had kidney failure and was on dialysis regularly, for a person to be on dialysis and be receiving blood on a regular basis, you have to have fairly sterile conditions, and you have to have a rather substantial supply of medical equipment, plasma, etc. How in the world would this be possible in Bora Bora or in many of the other places that he would have allegedly been over that period of time? The CIA would have been able to have tracked medical supply houses and anyone who could have sold him or one of his couriers, that they would have been on that rather easily. It would be like a person having to have chemotherapy, and you track where all the chemotherapy is going in that area, and you'd find him. So I just have questions. I can't prove anything. It's just my concern.
Yeah, it's clearer than that, though, Gary. Because Dan Rather, you can see this for yourself on YouTube, the day before 9/11 on September 10th, Dan Rather, CBS News, reported that bin Laden was in a hospital in Pakistan, I believe in either Karachi or Rawalpindi, Pakistan. And in mid-July of 2001, it was reported by Agency France Press and other European press that bin Laden was in the American hospital in Dubai having his procedure for kidney failure. He was having his procedure and was visited by the CIA station chief there. The CIA knew always where bin Laden was. He was their man. Sybil Edmonds made it very clear that the FBI documents that she translated shortly after 9/11 made it very clear that bin Laden was working for the U.S. and Western intelligence right up and through September 11th itself. Bin Laden is not who this administration and the previous Bush-Cheney administration has said he is. It's that simple.
Okay. I don't know. I wouldn't call it that simple. I would simply say that there are conflicting thoughts on it, and I don't believe that by any measure we have had the full measure of truth. Much like the 9/11, official 9/11 statements, you and many others have been able to simply deconstruct. That doesn't tell us absolutely who did anything. It simply tells us that every part of the story that we've been told up to this point doesn't hold a substance, and therefore it's legitimately criticized. So I always stop.
That is true.
I stop short of the third rail. The moment you hit the third rail and you start speculating, as some people have, they can discredit the whole movement, and maybe that is their intent, or maybe that's just an unintended consequence of some of the megalomaniacs out there who blather on about, we know who did it, and they did it, and yet I say, where is your absolute proof? And they don't have it, but they have a lot of speculation.
No. We don't know definitively who did 9/11. We do know definitively that it could not have been done by Al-Qaeda, because Al-Qaeda could not have had access to the inside of the Pentagon to plant the internal explosives that I have shown were the real story of 9/11, and Al-Qaeda could not have had access to World Trade Centers 1, 2, and 7 for at least weeks in advance to plant the controlled demolition charges throughout those buildings that brought them down on the morning of 9/11. Al-Qaeda could not have done the actual deed, the actual attack. If Al-Qaeda is a true organization separate from Western intelligence, deep black Western intelligence, which is an open question, but if it is, Al-Qaeda, at the very most, whoever the real top operatives in Al-Qaeda are, the top planners, at the very most could have planned something like 9/11, i.e. could have conspired to do something like the attacks of 9/11. But the truth movement has proven that they did not do the actual deed. And I'd just like to mention this to your producer. But are you aware, Gary, this is a critical breaking news about 9/11. In the January 10th New York Times, in an article I'm holding in my hand, the title of the article is U.S. to Press Fight of Detainees' Appeal. These are the Guantanamo Detainees' Appeal. And buried towards the end of this article, January 10th New York Times, very close to the end of this article on page A14, you learn that the United States government, the Obama administration, and the chief prosecutor and judge at Gitmo, at Guantanamo, have decided to drop the 9/11 conspiracy charges against Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the alleged mastermind of 9/11, against Bin al-Sheba, the alleged coordinator of the entire 9/11 plot, and the three others who are known as the 9/11 Five. The government is dropping all conspiracy charges against the people that they claim did 9/11. This is breaking news. It should be the top of every news story in the world, and yet it's buried on page A14 of the New York Times on January 10th.
I have, before we go to October Surprise, I have just a few questions that I cannot determine the veracity of the issue. I have interviewed many people and looked at the research of what happens when a major airline crashes into a mountain, into a forest, into the desert, into the ocean. In all circumstances, a substantial part of the plane is able to be retrieved. Yet, in Pennsylvania, there was nothing that came back from no bodies, no parts of bodies, none of the engine, the fuselage, the wings, nothing. The same is true at the Pentagon. Now, how in the world can you have a plane go into the Pentagon and do the damage it did, knowing the height of the plane, and not have an indentation in the wall where the plane at the speed per hour, and I've asked physicists, what would be the pressure per square inch when a plane's wings and other parts hit a building, and then you're going to have a hole, but you would also have, in effect, an entire outline. There should be parts of the plane, the wing, the tail, and the tail was tall. It's over 40 feet from ground to the top, yet you don't have...
Right, 44 feet.
You don't have that indentation. You don't have the indentation where the wings would have hit. Well, how do you vaporize the wings? In effect, what you have
you
have a relatively small hole. Well, you cannot, it goes against all laws of physics, you can't fit an entire airplane into a hole. It doesn't collapse on itself, and then, like a vortex, a black space hole, doesn't get sucked into infinity. There has to be debris, bodies, and material. Was there anything that identified itself as a plane at the scene after the crash?
Well, it's a two-part answer. And as you know, we've been on this program before going into great detail about it. The most important answer is at the point on the west wall of the Pentagon on 9/11 that the government claims Flight 77 hit. The answer is no. Absolute proof that there was not a plane that hit at that place. There aren't tails, there aren't wing parts, and not only that, most people don't know, that very section of the Pentagon, that very wedge one outside wall of the Pentagon, had just been hardened specifically to withstand a terrorist attack of either a bomb at or near the wall and or a very high force lateral impact, i.e. the impact of a plane. The wall had just been hardened to prevent a plane, even if it had hit, Gary, from going through that wall. It was like a huge Kevlar vest with special Kevlar material inside to prevent precisely that. So the bottom line is, no, a plane did not hit where the government said, and as you know from our previous programs on the Pentagon attack on 9/11, the initial huge violent events at the Pentagon that created the smoke and created the internal damage were caused by explosives that were described as smelling of cordite by people there. Cordite has a completely different, very special odor, very different than burning jet fuel. So, and that all, those violent events happened over 5 minutes before the government says that Flight 77 was anywhere near the building. So the bottom line, no, not where the government says a plane hit and not where the government, when the government says the plane hit. However, there was a plane that was destroyed at the Pentagon at 9:32 and 30 seconds over, much further north over by the heliport. But it was a white plane, it was a smaller plane, it was still a large plane, but it was white and it could not have been Flight 77 because all American Airlines planes, airliners, like Flight 77 was, a 757, are polished aluminum, and they don't look white. All of the witnesses said that was a white plane. So, but put aside that there was a plane that was destroyed at the Pentagon much earlier than the official lie at the Pentagon claims Flight 77 hit the building. Flight 77 didn't get anywhere near the Pentagon, and it didn't hit either where or when the official story says it did. That is a flat-out lie.
Were there reports of people hearing explosions inside the Pentagon?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Not only the smell of cordite, but they called them bombs going off. And as you know from my PowerPoint, which I've sent you, and which I would be happy to send any of your listeners, by the way, if you'll allow me to give my email towards the end of the program,
sure.
People will see for themselves the actual names and statements of the witnesses, multiple witnesses, both inside and outside the building, who experienced what they said were bombs going off inside the Pentagon on 9/11. And that all happened at least 5 minutes before the official story says Flight 77 was anywhere near Washington, D.C.
Okay. Now, and of course, for Building 7 to have fallen in free form the way it did, free fall, it would have had to have, by any estimate, some form of controlled demolition, and there was no plane that hit Building 7. So the only thing that I could speculate at this moment, and this is merely a subjective hypothesis, nothing more,
is
that individuals who I do not know, who had the power of national security and other investigatory agencies so they could have covered themselves, believed that it was in the interest of the United States to speed up the engagement in reorganizing our position within several countries in the Middle East. And there had already been papers written on this and published on this by a particular think tank about going into Libya, Syria, Iran, Iraq, Afghanistan, and ultimately even in Russia. And to get to Russia. And that they had to have a false flag operation. And knowing that there were terrorists in the United States, that is not in dispute. That is absolute. The CIA and the FBI and national security knew that there were elements of Al-Qaeda. There were Saudi extremists and terrorists who had been planning. But they didn't have the capability. They only had the desire.
Correct.
So by...
Nor the access.
By piggybacking on, all right, we have some people who are going to commit a coordinated attack. And then if, and again, this is purely speculative, but if they chose then to capitalize on that and make them the fall guys, the patsies, then they could have set this into motion that would have almost guaranteed that nobody would question our military adventures anywhere in the world and what we would do with anyone who opposed it. It also would allow our own freedoms to be erased with the Patriot Act and Homeland Security Act and element. National Defense Authorization Act, et cetera, and it would allow an enormous new industry, the military-industrial spy industry, and all that's come from that to exist if they did it. So an awful lot of people would benefit, though I don't believe an awful lot of people were engaged in the planning of this, but they had to be the most powerful people in the United States because they had to be coordinated. That's merely my speculation. True or not, I don't know. All I know is that the official report is completely untrue, and thousands of experts and scientists and physicists and architects say that it's completely wrong. And also the same thing with the Pentagon.
Yes, absolutely. And I would just like to mention, in case you don't have it yourself, Gary, and for your listeners, that the 9/11 Commission report is, as Professor David Ray Griffin, the World Dean of 9/11 Research, has stated very clearly and explicitly, a 571-page lie. However, the truth, to the extent after 11 years that the 9/11 truth movement researchers and scholars and engineers have been able to pull together and demonstrate and back up and prove to the extent that we know today. It's called the 9/11 Toronto Report, and it is now available. It was published last November. It's available now on Amazon.com for something like $12, and every American should read it because the cover of the 9/11 Toronto Report was specifically designed by the editor, James Gourley, attorney James Gourley, to look identical at a distance to the 9/11 Commission Report. So if you hold the 9/11 Commission Report up next to the 9/11 Toronto Report a few feet away, you can't tell the difference between the covers. But inside the 9/11 Toronto Report is the truth. And it's based upon the academic papers with full references and citations from those of us who were expert witnesses at the Toronto hearings on the 10th anniversary of 9/11. And I highly recommend that you order a copy and that every one of your listeners also order a copy. It's called the 9/11 Toronto Report, available on Amazon.com.
All right, now we're going to shift gears. But put this in context for a lot of people who would think this is just incredulous. It couldn't happen. First, a caveat. What other false flag operations that are a matter of fact now that we know for sure actually happened? And the consequences of those false flag operations, including the Gulf and Tonkin episode, look, that led to over 3.4 million people dying in Vietnam, over 500,000 Laos and Cambodia. So you're talking about 4 million people dead because of a false flag operation, and it went on for almost 10 years in Vietnam. And Lyndon Johnson was fully aware of it. What other false flag operations have occurred that are provable and no longer a matter of contention?
Well, that's an excellent question, and I'm not an expert on all of them. However, what I'd like to do is mention the one that I believe is the most similar to the 9/11 false flag, the 9/11 attack false flag. And I remind your listeners that just about a week ago, the government decided that they were going to drop the conspiracy charges for the 9/11 attacks against the person that they claim is the mastermind of the attacks, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, and the other 9/11 five now being held awaiting their military tribunal in Guantanamo Bay. So the most important thing to realize is not just the United States government, but governments and those in power and authority throughout history have preferred false flag attacks. And by that we mean when a government frames up a patsy, usually another country or an organization, to take the blame, to take false blame for an attack so that they can then demonize that enemy and then go and attack that enemy or use that as a pretext for some other geopolitical goal, usually a war of some kind that they're planning. The most parallel attack that I can think of for the 9/11 false flag attacks is the Reichstag fire by the Nazis and Adolf Hitler. And why is that? Because the best historical analysis is that there was a real communist agent who was planning to plant a bomb in the parliament building in Germany, the Reichstag. And the Nazis had excellent spies. They learned, just like the United States government, like the CIA, especially, and the FBI, and the Defense Intelligence Agency before 9/11, had every single detail of the purported 9/11 plot by Al-Qaeda before 9/11. Also, the Nazis knew about the plot by the Dutch communists to plant a bomb in Reichstag. But Hitler realized that it was to his benefit that he could seize power in Germany faster than he would have been able to otherwise if he allowed the plot to go forward, protected the bomber who was planning to plant it, make sure that he survived until he did plant the bomb, and then the Nazis planted additional very spectacular explosives in the Reichstag to ensure a spectacular attack. And then Hitler used that attack to seize power in Germany and immediately pass what was called the Enabling Act, which gave him effectively dictatorial powers. The parallel of the Enabling Act in the United States after 9/11, of course, was the Patriot Act, which everyone knows was an extremely long 800 pages or something. No one wrote the Patriot Act after 9/11. It was waiting to be implemented and given to Congress immediately after the attack. So the best parallel with the 9/11 attack is, in fact, the Reichstag fire that catapulted Hitler to power.
Well, we have then, too. We have Hitler's Germany and the genocide and 40 million dead throughout Russia and Europe and 6 million Jews. That's one false flag that worked. And another was Vietnam, the Gulf of Tonkin. So we're talking about two false flags that had incredible consequences. So it could have been another false flag. Now to the subject at hand. Please take us uninterrupted on the October surprise. Give us the beginning, middle, and end, the cast of characters, how they did it, and why a Senate investigation did not find anything. The House investigation, several investigations, claimed that they were doing an independent review and came up without the results. You, however, Barbara Honecker, former White House policy analyst and special assistant to the president for domestic policy, you found the truth. Take us through the story now, please.
Well, would you allow me to ask you a quick question before I do that?
Yes.
I'm interested why today you're interested in this particular topic, which is, after all, 32 years ago.
I'm interested because this is the radio station, number one, by the way, in the world of some 43,000 internet radio stations. We're number one, according to Google search. And talking with Professor James Tracy, Peter Dale Scott, Professor John Pilger, Stephen Ledman, and many others, many of us believe that we could be about to experience another black flag operation in the near future in order for the government to further its imperial agenda and further consolidate its economic and military leverage in the Middle East and elsewhere.
Okay. So the reason for the interest, I thought so, but I'm glad you said so. Without having stated it explicitly, I believe that you are interested in the current relevance of the October surprise, because it involves Iran and the hidden, deep black relationship between especially right-wing elements of the U.S. government and the Israeli government with the radical Islamists in Iran, but in particular because you believe, as I do, that the Israelis, certainly, if not the Americans as well, would dearly love to see a false flag attack that they could blame on Iran as a pretext for attacking Iran and taking out its purported nuclear capability. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct.
Okay. Well, yes. The October surprise is not directly relevant to this, but it is very importantly indirectly relevant to the near future situation, and that is that the rhetoric that we hear coming out of Washington, especially by the Republicans, less so by the Democrats, but also by the Democrats, is that Iran, that the number one threat to Israel, certainly, and they claim, as a result of that, to United States national security, they claim that a threat to Israel is a threat to the United States. I personally do not think that that is a true statement, but they always make that claim. If you assume or believe that that is an accurate claim, both parties in Washington, D.C. want the American public to believe that the greatest threat to the United States is a nuclear Iran. Well, I'm here to tell you, first off, and I will get into the October surprise. I'm here to tell you, first off, that there's something wrong with this picture, and let me explain very simply why, as I mentioned to your producer when he called about this program earlier today. And that is that a careful reading of the New York Times and the Washington Post, or even going to the State Department, the United States State Department's own webpage, you will see that the number one pretext or reason that our government, the U.S. government, gives for wanting to put a Star Wars anti-nuclear missile shield in Europe, in Central and Eastern Europe, against Russia, is the threat that they claim comes from nuclear-tipped ballistic missiles from Iran. Now, the United States wants very badly to have this, as it were, Star Wars system on the ground again in Europe. But their reason for fanning the flames of fear in Europe to try to get it is the claim that there is a credible near-future threat from not only Iran having a nuclear weapon, but having missiles that they put that nuclear weapon on top of, intermediate-range nuclear weapons, that can reach Europe. Now, the United States government cannot have it both ways. We cannot claim that we don't want Iran to have a nuclear weapon and the ballistic missiles to put them on top of, and also claim that there's a credible threat from Iran having exactly just that in order to get a Star Wars system against Russia in Europe. Now, there's something wrong with this picture. So you have to ask yourself, what is the real deep foreign policy of the United States? And I personally think it still has more to do with, I believe, a paranoid and unrealistic fear of Russia than it does of Iran.
I agree with that. But Barbara, I don't want us to run out of time before you tell us the story of October Surprise.
Could you please tell us that? Yes, I will. All right, my book October Surprise was published on May 12, 1989. And it is not a coincidence that on that precise day, one of the chief witnesses, eyewitnesses in my book, a man by the name of Richard Reneke, who was running arms and drugs as part of Iran-Contra, that Richard Reneke was sued for perjury for what he claimed was true about the October Surprise secret deal between the Khomeini regime in Iran and the Reagan-Bush 1980 campaign, which was that there was an arms-for-hostage delay meeting that was held in Paris, France, on October 18th and 19th, 1980, between George Bush Sr., William Casey, who was the 1980 Reagan-Bush campaign manager, soon to become CIA director, the first CIA director under Reagan and Bush Sr., and Donald Gregg, and believe it or not, also Robert Gates, recently both CIA director and Secretary of Defense. That these men met in October of 1980 and cut a secret deal with the Khomeini regime to withhold the release of the hostages, which President Carter was trying desperately to get free before the 1980 election, to ensure Carter's defeat, and then further hold them until Inauguration Day to make sure that Carter didn't get any credit for the release of the hostages, ensuring that our 52 hostages, our 52 Americans who were held captive originally in the U.S. Embassy in Tehran, later scattered elsewhere throughout Tehran, as well as in even prison outside Tehran, that they would be held for an additional 3 months, some of whom were during that time tortured. So this was the October Surprise deal. And on the very day that my book was published, it is not a coincidence that at that time, George Bush Sr. had just become President of the United States, and his Attorney General sued the chief eyewitness in my book to the October Surprise meetings, Richard Reneke, for perjury. Well, lo and behold, almost exactly 1 year later, on May 4th of 1990, Richard Reneke won his case, which the Bush Sr. administration literally had made the October Surprise into a federal case, thinking they would win it. But the jury of our peers, the jury of his peers, found him innocent of all 60 charges of lying. In other words, they believed my book, and they believed his testimony, and they believed that the 1980 Reagan-Bush campaign and the Israelis had cut a secret deal with the most radical elements of the Khomeini regime to delay the release of our 52 hostages in Iran. That's the October surprise. Richard Brennecke was found innocent of all charges, and it was banner headlines around the world, including banner headlines in the San Francisco Chronicle, which I read that very next day. And as he was freed and took questions from hundreds of press corps on the front steps of Portland, Oregon's federal courthouse, you could see in the national news coverage that before he took questions, he made two telephone calls. He made a telephone call first to his wife to inform her that he was a free man, and then he made a telephone call to me to thank me. Now, that's the October surprise. And subsequent to that, as a result of my book, and after my book was published, a book by the same title, also called October Surprise, by Gary Sick, former Navy intelligence captain Gary Sick, who was President Carter's chief Iran expert in the National Security Council in the West Wing of the White House throughout the hostage crisis. Gary Sick, 3 years after my book, published a book by the same title, October Surprise, in which he also came to the identical conclusion, because the evidence forces you to the conclusion that the Reagan-Bush campaign in 1980, led by George Bush Sr. himself, actually cut a deal with the most radical Shiite Islamists in the world to this day, to hold the release, to delay the release of the 52 hostages, to ensure Carter's defeat, and they're taking the reins of power. And only when Reagan put his hand up and completed his oath of office were those 52 hostages instantly released to yellow ribbons around the world, and a tremendous propaganda coup for the right wing, the same right wing establishment who continued to then send at least $5 billion worth of secret arms to the Iranians to continue to fight their 8-year war with Iraq, the famous Iran-Iraq war. We were supplying arms and weapons to both sides of that war because, in my personal opinion, that was what was good for Israel. It was good for Israel to keep its two number one enemies in its own eyes, Iran and Iraq at the time, fighting each other so that they would not attack Israel or would not fight Israel, would not go after Israel. So that's basically the story of the October surprise. And as a result of both my book and then Gary Sick's book 3 years later by the same title, October Surprise, there was then a Senate investigation into the October surprise. And I have to respectfully disagree with you that it didn't find anything, Gary. In fact, the Senate and House investigations, especially the House investigation, which was a full subpoena power Watergate-level investigation voted by the then democratically controlled House of Representatives, that investigation actually was funded at a higher level than the entire 9/11 attack investigation by the 9/11 Commission. And it resulted in the October Surprise Task Force report published by the Government Printing Office, which I think everyone should actually read. Because when you actually read the entire text of the House October Surprise Task Force, you see that the so-called executive summary at the beginning, which is all that the media had had time to read, a few pages, is a complete misstatement of what was actually found by the October Surprise Task Force. And subsequent to that, Robert Perry, whom I know you've had on your program, a great journalist who actually broke the Iran side of Iran-Contra in Newsweek before he resigned from Newsweek when Newsweek refused to take the October Surprise story seriously, Robert Perry then continued the investigation and received, by someone inside the October Surprise Task Force, had collected the classified documents that are no longer classified, had collected the documents and leaked them to Robert Perry, and you can now read the documents from the government itself that prove the October surprise on Bob Perry's website, www.consortiumnews.com, and then click on the October Surprise X-Files, as well as read Robert Perry's excellent, at least a dozen articles that he has published since the October Surprise investigation, the report of which was released in January of 1993, just before Clinton became president. So I was in Washington for the release of that task force report. The October Surprise has, bottom line, subsequently been vindicated and validated by previously classified, now released documents that you can read for yourself on the Robert Perry's website, consortiumnews.com.
Barbara, we're out of time. Let me just add one additional comment. It was also under the Reagan and Bush administration that the Iran-Contra affair happened, and the cocaine coming to America, cash and arms going to the Contras, who were Somoza's National Guard fighting the Sandinistas and others. And had it not been for a plane crash and documents uncovered, and we would not have known of that. And that was another complete fraud and lied. And though some people were held accountable for it under hearings, Reagan got a free pass. Thank you very much for all your good work, Barbara. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on again. I appreciate it.
Barbara Honecker, my guest, talking about not just October Surprise, but also others. And Barbara, please give your website out for people who would like to get your talking points.
Yes. They would need to email me. And you email me, I will send you my PowerPoint slides on the Pentagon attack on 9/11. And that is B as in boy, S as in Sam, H as in Harry, O, N as in Nancy, E, two G's like go-go, at gmail.com. So repeating, B-S-H-O-N-E-G-G at gmail.com. Thank you, Gary.
Thank you. I'd like to thank all of you for listening. I look forward to sharing more on our next program. Have a nice day.